This story may appear on the surface to be about ski jumping, but in truth, it represents something far greater. It's a tribute to all those who dare to dream, who aim for the impossible heights, who give their all, regardless of whether they reach the summit. This is for the romantics, the purists, the idealists and the chancers, those eternal optimists who persist whatever the odds. It speaks to anyone who's ever set out to achieve something special, to those with a well of hope that never runs dry. It's for all the people who refuse to give in, who are undeterred by doubters, naysayers and doom-mongers. It's for everyone who pursues their passion simply for the love of the sport, the enjoyment and for what truly matters. Ultimately, this is a celebration of the spirit, an acknowledgement of the little boys and little girls inside each of us who long to reach beyond our normal limits. It's an ode to dreaming big, to never surrendering, and to having the courage to live boldly. This is the Winter Olympic Series, and this is the Sporting Almanac Podcast. The underdogs, Jack.
The underdogs, man. It's what the Olympics is about.
This is what me and you get up in the morning for. Underdog stories.
It really is.
Something that is alien to the American.
We've been saying this over and over again. You don't have to win a gold medal to be a legend at the Olympics. And as a British person, when we're talking about the Winter Olympics, there is only one person who fits that particular category. Mm-hmm. And it is this man, the legend. The eagle himself.
Michael David Edwards, better known as?
Better known as Eddie Edwards or Eddie the Eagle.
Eddie the Eagle.
And his sport was ski jumping.
Let's talk about ski jumping, I think. And I think that is the right order because people need to understand what he was seeking to do before we can tell his story. Yeah, ski jumping, pretty simple.
I mean, yeah, he didn't choose an easy sport. He actually originally tried to be an alpine skier. That was his first intention, to try and be a downhill skier, but he transitioned to ski jumping because presumably that wasn't terrifying enough.
Yeah, ski jumping is terrifying. Yeah, I actually don't know how you get into it. I don't know how you become a ski jumper, especially if you're British, but it's essentially a massive...
I don't know where you go to train. Well,
yeah, you have to go to Europe, I assume. It is essentially a massive ramp with a big jump off the end. There are two different heights. Or two different size ramps. They call them hills. And yeah, you just jump as far as you can, really. But it's not just your distance you get. Like with a lot of Winter Olympic sports, actually, like, you know, the snowboarding, which we were talking about, you get points for sort of style. And there are a couple of other factors as well.
Yeah.
I think you're landing and that sort of thing. And there is an algorithm that calculates a score for you.
Yeah, it's very unusual for a jumping sport, actually. It's not measured on distance alone. And I remember watching it. Presumably at the Winter Olympics, although maybe even on Eurosport, because I've seen it outside the Winter Olympics on Eurosport. It is an immensely popular sport in the mountainous areas of Central Europe and obviously in Scandinavia as well. And I remember thinking it is mad that it's not just measured on distance, but that is but one small factor. You've also got to do it with style, and I love that.
Yeah, you got to do it stylishly. Yeah,
it's very very old sport as well.
Literally going to say exactly the same thing, included in every program of the Winter Olympics. So from 1924 to now, basically. Yeah. And I think until 56, it was just one hill and the length of that hill varied depending on who was hosting and presumably the available resources, yeah. Etc. But it's been standardized since. You basically have a large and a normal hill are the two types. The length is determined by the K point, which, you know, you would love because it's very physics-y, very maths.
I do.
But I think apparently it's the point on the landing hill at which the hill itself starts to flatten. It's basically the target point for the competitors. So they jump down the slope, so to speak, and they try to land as the slope begins to level out. And the large hill has a massive run up to the takeoff point. Yeah. 120 meters and the normal hill is 90.
Yeah.
Which is quite insane. And women actually haven't been doing it for very long.
It is insane. If you have ever been downhill skiing or done any skiing of any type, you probably haven't gone straight for 120 meters because that's how long you have to get up to speed on the large hills, and 90 meters on the normal hills. Note, we are not calling them the small hills. They are just the normal hills. Either way, it's super high speed. It's terrifying. But yeah, like you're saying, women have only been competing since 2014, which is incredible. I wouldn't have thought that in the slightest. The IOC only accepted it into their events in 2011, women ski jumping. That is way too late. That's incredible.
Yeah.
I can't think of any logical reason why.
Because the IOC are really inclusive.
Well, that's obviously not the reason, Ben.
No. We've done our rants on them. It is far too late. But they now can, ever since 2011, and as you say, first games, Sochi, in 2014. Yeah. It's a pretty, like, I guess the thing that's quite interesting about this sport is that no country really dominates it. There have been 16 different countries that have won medals, but is it the last five games have had five different nationalities win?
Yeah, I think you're right. There's not many, as you say, not many nations, relatively speaking, compete. As I said, those mountainous countries in Central Europe like Austria and those Scandi countries like Norway and Finland, they love it. They dominate it traditionally, but also Germany, Switzerland and the like, but not the United Kingdom, to be fair.
Yeah, we are not well-versed in the art of ski jumping. Do you want to tell everyone when we have entered it and how we fared?
Well, this is not even like these are the times that we got close to a medal or anything. This is only the times we've actually entered it. We've only had entrants in 1924, 2002, and we'll be talking about this today, 1988. In 1924, our athletes didn't actually take to the hill in the end anyway. They just entered but didn't even take a jump. So the first time anyone actually took a jump at the ski jumping at the Olympics was in 1988.
Michael David Edwards, who we introduced at the top of the show. Yeah, what an interesting bloke this guy is.
I mean, what a mad bloke this guy is. You talk about having a dream and making it happen, no matter what stands in your way, even when what stands in your way is your own talent and experience, relatively speaking. And I mean relatively speaking, because he's doing stuff that I would never even think about doing.
No, for sure. And like, but that is actually a very fair thing to say in this. Like, he had a dream that he didn't, objectively speaking, have the talent to achieve.
Yeah.
But he was a combination of luck, circumstance, but predominantly hard graft, determination, willpower.
Not taking no for an answer, yeah.
Yeah, like that's what gets you there. And it's just so wonderful, really. Like, and we're not spoiling the end here to say he made it there and he captured the hearts and minds of everyone, not just the British, everyone in Calgary in 1988. But the story of how he got there is the thing that is the romance of this story.
Yeah, so for sure.
We should probably tell it. We should probably say how he started out and how he got there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was born in on the 5th of December 1963 in Cheltenham, Gloucestershire. And if you've been to
for its ski jumping.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you've ever been to Gloucestershire, Cheltenham is lovely. Gloucestershire is lovely. One of the most, like, the Cotswolds are there, one of the most lovely parts of the country. Not many mountains around there.
Not much
Definitely
snow.
Not many ski jumping. Definitely not much snow. This is all a very relative term, but it is one of the warmest parts of England down there. We talked about Sean White a few episodes ago, talked about him skiing since he was basically standing almost, and he was snowboarding since he was 6 years old. Well, Eddie, he didn't even ski until a school trip age 13 was the first time he even strapped a pair of skis on. From there, he was hooked from the first moment he put a pair of skis on. He was an obsessive. He was a huge fan. He had to develop his skills on dry ski slopes because, as I mentioned, nowadays you do get indoor powder snow ski places all over the country, which are great and fun to go to and a great way to practice in the United Kingdom where there aren't many mountains. Back then it was dry ski slopes, and I don't know if anyone's been on a dry ski slope. Not quite representative of the real thing, and very, very painful if you were to fall over.
Yeah,
I did it for a while myself and took quite a lot of skin off as a result. But he had a dream. He had a dream to become a downhill skier. He was able to work a bit in Scotland, at Glenshee in Scotland, which allowed him access to at least what the United Kingdom closest representation of a snowy mountain.
All we had to offer, yeah.
But he started off wanting to be, as I said, he wanted to be a downhill skier, but he quickly realized he wasn't going to make the grade as a downhill skier, but more importantly, that it was too expensive to do that. But he wanted to stay in the game.
Yeah.
And how did he stay in the game? Well, he switched to ski jumping, basically because there weren't any other British ski jumpers, and therefore there was no competition for a place, essentially.
Can't deny the logic.
Which is bold.
Can't deny the logic. Yeah. The strategy. It's like hanging back at the in a final of short track speed skating, really. Just a British version.
It is a very British way to get into the event. It's like, when all else fails, get there by default. Yeah. That's how you do it.
Yeah, I mean, when he started, he didn't have any money, I don't think.
No, he didn't have anything.
No financial support for training, completely self-funded, slept in his car at times. And then I think this is rumour, because like, stories take on a life of their own, and like you always say, don't let the truth get in the way of a good story. So the suggestion is that once or twice he even sort of basically foraged for food out of bins and stuff just to make ends meet. You know, believe that if you want, it does add to it. but the point is, it was hard.
It was, and obviously adding to this, the fact there were no ski jumping facilities in the United Kingdom for him to train at didn't help either. So he had to go out to New York, to a place we talked about a few episodes ago as well, Lake Placid, which is where the 1980 Olympics were, most famously the Miracle on Ice took place there. But of course, as a result of them having hosted the Winter Olympics, they had the facilities there for him to go and train. And obviously there were options in Europe as well, but they restricted who had access to them. You had to have a certain amount of competence, whereas the Americans, you just have to have the right amount of money to give to them, and then they will let you have a go on their ski jump.
Yeah, it's not even heart.
Different
world. It's just finances. Show me the dollar.
That's all it takes. But yeah, he started jumping there under the supervision of a couple of coaches, John Viscombe and Chuck Berghorn, in Lake Placid, as I said. He didn't have any of his own equipment. So he had to borrow Berghorn's. He had to wear six pairs of socks to even make Berghorn's his ski boots fit.
I love that bit. Just keep layering it up until they don't move.
he was held back as well by his physique, you could say. Now these pros he was up against, they're svelte, they're athletes. Yeah. They cut lean through the air cleanly. Lean, yeah, get out to speed quickly.
Aerodynamic.
Don't let physics stand in the way. he was 82 kilograms, if you like that. 181 pounds, 12 stone, 13 pounds if you prefer, which is approximately 9 kilograms or 20 pounds if you prefer. Heavier than his next heaviest competitor. So, you know, not quite as svelte as them. Obviously not a huge guy, but it's all relative.
But 10%. And when you're talking elite sport,
yeah,
like that's, yeah, that's a huge difference.
Yeah, yeah. And it all adds up. All these sort of micro differences will add up to a big difference in the whole. But he was also disadvantaged very, very famously by his very poor eyesight.
This is the best thing about Eddie the Eagle.
So for any of you who've seen a picture of Eddie Eagle, the first thing from the 80s, this is the first thing that will jump out of you is his glasses were about as big as his face and super thick rimmed. He was extremely far-sighted. He had to wear thick glasses under his goggles, which would obviously miss. I've done this before myself, obviously I'm a glasses wearer. They missed up very quickly. You have to wear contact lenses, but this was the 1980s and the technology available to him wasn't quite there. So he's wearing these massive Dennis Taylor style glasses while competing. He's just a very noticeable, recognizable man.
Yeah. And it's endearing.
It's all exactly endearing. It captured the heart of the British public because he was just one of us.
It's just a bloke.
Absolutely.
Having a crack at the Olympics, doing a bit of ski
jumping. Why the
jumping.
Hell not?
Wild, mate. But like,
it is incredible.
But yeah, this is the thing that, like, when people say, oh, you know, you've inspired a generation and stuff, you do, because anyone could relate to this guy. Like, there was nothing special about him. He was just your average guy with a dream, which he was chasing.
The only thing he had any different from anyone else was he didn't take no for an answer. He had a never say die, a dream and a determination to get there. But anyone can have a dream and a determination to get there.
Yeah.
Any one of us can get out of bed tomorrow and say, I want to do this crazy thing, and do our best to make it happen. yeah, you might not get there. You might hit too many walls and have to give up. He just kept going and kept going and kept going. And suddenly he was stood at the top of a ski ramp at the World Championships in Oberstdorf in Bavaria in 1987.
Insane. And that...
representing Great Britain.
That would have been, in and of itself, insane. A World Championships for a bloke. I mean, obviously the dominoes have got to fall your way, but like, to get there and just jump at a World Championships,
yeah,
that would have been spectacular. But it wouldn't have etched you into folklore, because the World Championships don't have the mystique,
no,
and the lure of the Winter Olympics. So where did he come at the World Champs, Jack?
he came 55th,
last,
which is, you know, 55th best. He came 55th. He was the 55th best ski jumper in the world. We'll ignore the fact that the Austrians probably had about 50 people trying to qualify for their couple of two or three spots in the team. We'll ignore that. He and we'll say he was the 55th best in the world.
Yep. Well, you know, can't deny the facts. And like, you would have thought, right? Like, well, maybe, I don't know, maybe you wouldn't have thought, given all the context that we've provided. But obviously nowadays, athletes receive funding. They're all sponsored and so on and so forth. And you would have thought maybe getting to a World Championships would have bestowed Eddie some of that financial support, but it didn't. Between ski jumping events, he was working as a plasterer. And at times, he was living in a Finnish mental hospital due to a lack of funds and an alternative accommodation. Like,
he wasn't put there because he was ski jumping without any experience, I should point out. He was just living there because they had rooms available. Yeah, but even so, it's like a good story.
Living in a psychiatric hospital because he didn't have anywhere else to stay in Finland. And that's where was that where he was when he received confirmation?
I think so, yeah.
That his World Championship performance had qualified him for the 88 Games.
Yeah, that'll do it. Jeez. 55th in the world. Why would he not let him in the Olympics?
He'd only been ski jumping for 20 months when he qualified for the Calgary Winter Olympics, and that made him Britain's first ever competitor in the event, as we said at the top. So
incredible.
Yeah.
It's such a good story, and like, British Olympic backing, like the Olympic funding, has improved a lot in the past 30 years, particularly with national lottery funding, etc., etc.
Post-Atlanta, it is very... when we were terrible.
Yeah, so we won one gold medal at the Atlanta Summer Olympics. And then we started to invest. I think we won 10 in 2000, and that was all the way up to like 29, I think we won a few years ago. So it's made a huge difference. Basically, it allows these talented amateurs to become professionals almost, so not have to go to their day job, certainly not as much, and they can focus, they can have better training, professional coaches, better level of equipment, everything like that. It's always been heavily favoring the Summer Olympics. There is a lot of funding still for the Winter Olympics if you've got the talent to deserve sort of the level of investment. Back in the 80s, I mean, there was nothing for almost anything. If you weren't making money on your own back for your athletics, which, I mean, you go back to the 70s, technically no one was. There was money under the table, but everyone was supposed to be amateurs. By the 80s, it was becoming professional, but if you weren't making money off your own back, you had to self-fund yourself and work in the meantime. And of course, yeah, as you said, he was a plasterer.
Yeah, it was good luck, basically. It was just good luck. You know, see how you get on.
Yeah, I mean, they'll talk about you after the fact if you do well, but before the fact and in the build-up, they won't give you the investment you need. Fortunately, that has changed a lot, but
yeah,
it took a long time. And even then, it's only changed because of national lottery funding.
For sure.
Which is essentially semi-private funding.
I completely agree with everything there. I mean, it's changed for the better.
Of course.
And it does just add that layer of wonder, really, to his ability to even get to the games. But get to the games he did, and at the games itself, Jack, how did our champion get on?
Well, he took part in the 70-meter and 90-meter events, and he did, I would say, I think he met the level of performance you would expect him to have, to be fair. He didn't underachieve, it's fair to say.
No, he didn't underachieve.
He came last in both competitions.
Came last.
He scored 69.2 points with two jumps of 55 metres in the 70-metre event. To put into context, second last, Bernat Soler Puyol of Spain scored 140.4 points. That's more than double points, and jumped 71 metres and 68.5 metres. So, you know, 15-odd metres faster than him. And to put into even more context, Matti Nykänen of Finland had 229.1 points from 89.5 metre jumps for his gold medal. So, yeah. How about the 90 metres?
I mean, we're just outside the medals, basically.
I mean, yeah, all he needs to do is find that extra, you know, sort of like 40%. That's all you need.
And so, yeah, maybe the weight wasn't the biggest problem. But he had another shot in the 90-meter event. How'd he get on there? I mean, we know he came last, but what are we scoring?
57.5 points from 71 and 67-meter jumps. Todd Gilman of Canada came second last with 110.8 points. Again, actually, no, not quite double. Not quite double on this occasion. So you could say he did better in that one. He jumped 96 meters and 86.5 meters. And the winner, again, Matti Nykänen, probably should be doing an episode on him. It sounds like he's quite a talented bloke. He won 224 points, 118.5 and 107 meters, which is quite far.
It is far. And to say that the crowd loved Eddie is an understatement.
Why would you not?
They absolutely loved him. At the closing ceremony, the president of the organizing committee, a chap called Frank King, singled him out for his contribution to the games and basically addressing all of the competitors said, "You broke world records and you've established personal bests. Some of you have even soared like an eagle," which is
it's so nice.
Like, but not everyone loved him. Like, some people, obviously, there's always naysayers, party poopers, you know, doom mongers, the people that you don't want in your life.
Take it too seriously, man.
Yeah.
Like, think about the bigger picture.
And one of those people, we're going to call him out, Bengt Erik Bengtsson, and I'm not even going to try and repronounce it properly because he's such an idiot. He was the head of the Nordic division of the International Ski Federation, and he criticized Eddie for being an Olympic tourist and distracting attention away from the accomplishments of the more capable athletes. Oh, did he? Go fuck yourself. And the East German newspaper, Jung Welt, labelled Edwards a clown. East Germany, with your doping record, you can shut your fucking mouths and all.
They take it very seriously, Ben. They take it so seriously. They were forcing enough testosterone into women to force them to have to change their sex at a later point. That's how seriously they took it.
Yeah, I know.
So, absolutely. So don't want any of this fun.
The flag bearers of the Olympic spirit here. Fucking chatting nonsense. Absolute rubbish.
Fucking East Germany. Jesus.
Yeah. Just pipe down, East Germany.
Oh, have a look at yourselves.
The annoying thing is, as well, though, is that half these half-wits work for the IOC.
Oh, yeah.
Or at least have affiliations to or influence over. And the rubbish part of this story is that because he received so much attention, because he was such a legend, because he was the people's champ, they changed the entry requirements, like the IOC bigwigs. They made it. They basically just made it impossible for anyone to follow his example. Yeah, they changed the rule. Became known as the Eddie the Eagle rule, and it required Olympic hopefuls to compete in international events and be placed in the top 30% of the top 50 competitors, or whichever is fewer. And it's just like,
that's incredible.
Talk about like a glass ceiling. Do you know what I mean?
I hate it. I mean, I have absolutely no problem, because especially in competitions where you have heats or qualifying rounds, I have absolutely no problem with this person is the best available person in this particular sport from this particular country. Exactly. And if it just so happens it's a country that doesn't have a ski jumping program or doesn't have a swimming program, as what happened later, a few years later, with the, oh, what's the guy in the pool? Eric the Eel, yeah. That kind of thing. Yeah, he came from a very small... He'd never seen an Olympic-sized swimming pool until he got to the Olympics. And yet he competed, and it was wonderful and memorable, and one of the clips that gets played over and over again. Like, what is the point of you holding this sports tournament if it isn't to create these stories and to give the people something to celebrate? And years later, after the fact, people are still watching those clips. I guarantee that Eddie the Eagle clip has been watched far more times than the gold, silver, and bronze medal jumps from that Olympics. It's not to like belittle. Obviously, we've already said that the Finnish dude who won a couple of golds is clearly extraordinary. Not to belittle him, his achievement will live forever.
I didn't know who he was. I know who Eddie the Eagle
exactly.
is.
And same with Eric the Eel. Same with him. Like, I don't know who won the gold in that event.
No.
When it all came said and done, I know who did his best in the qualifying heat and stole the hearts of anyone watching.
That's it.
Like, what's it about?
What is
what's
it about?
Sport about?
Yeah, like, don't get me wrong. You can and should, and there will be plenty of opportunity to celebrate your champions, your gold medalists, and the best of the best. But why does that mean you can't celebrate like the endeavor and the spirit of people like Eddie the Eagle. Like, why are you trying to shut the door to that? Like, I'm not saying you make a mockery of the event, but like you said, there's nothing wrong with someone representing their nation on the biggest stage of all and getting there and coming up short against the best. That I thought that was the whole reason the Olympic Games existed, but they changed the rules.
Yeah. I know we're going off topic here by talking about Eric the Eel, but I should point out he actually won his heat.
Yeah,
he won his heat because everyone else got disqualified.
That's what I mean.
He won a 100-meter freestyle heat in 1:52.
Yeah, he looked like he was going to drown.
I mean, it's incredible. Absolutely incredible. Like, bearing in mind the winning time for that Olympics was 48 seconds for that event. And the world record now is, I think, about 46 seconds. Incredible.
Yeah, it's incredible.
But you love to see it. It's so memorable.
You do love to see it. And the thing that's so annoying, mate, is that the person most impacted by like the change of the rules was Eddie himself. Because he never went to another Olympic Games. He didn't qualify for 92 in Albertville. He didn't go 94 to Lillehammer. He did manage to conjure up some sponsorship because of his, you know, fame, I guess, from an airline who tried to effectively fund him to get to Nagano in 98. But again, he wasn't able to qualify because obviously it would have required him, as you said, to improve his ability by like 50% to even have a look in.
Yeah, but he probably still remained the best British ski jumper of that time. And I imagine, because I've not got the details on the 2002 jumper that we had, I can probably guarantee he was probably inspired in no small part by Eddie the Eagle. And he obviously met the standards to qualify there.
I imagine.
I will have to quickly find out who that was. But, I mean, he's an Olympic icon.
He is an Olympic icon. And the Canadians didn't forget, man, because the Canadians clearly loved the story as much as we did. And when the Olympics went back there, 2010 to Vancouver, Eddie the Eagle was one of the torchbearers on the torch relay. And I think he did it in Winnipeg, as it obviously made its way to the cauldron, as these things do.
Yeah, it was a man named Glyn Pederson, who was the next British qualifier. He was actually born in Canada, so probably, I mean, he would have been 7 years old when Eddie jumped, I'm sure. He saw it.
Yeah.
Being in Canada and being of British origin, I'm sure that played a part. I don't know. I haven't got the info, but I wouldn't bet against it.
I think it's a decent working theory. I mean, there is one other guy I want to quickly mention before we end this episode, because it's on the same theme and it's also Winter Olympics based. But I found this quote about Eddie, basically saying that it's a quintessentially British story. And I think it actually is perfect. It said, "Eddie the Eagle could not be a star in any other country than the United Kingdom. He had a go. He dared to go where most of us won't. He stood at the top of the precipice and just said, Geronimo." Which is quality, isn't it? The other guy, just very quickly, who I wanted to mention, because we are talking underdogs and we're talking the greatest underdog in the Winter Olympics, as far as the Brit is concerned, was a guy called Philip Bois, who was a cross-country skier and the first ever Kenyan to participate in the Games. And
I love that.
Yeah, he was a former middle distance runner, no previous skiing experience whatsoever. And along with another Kenyan chap, he was bidding to become the first Kenyan to go to the Winter Olympics. The project was actually sponsored by Nike. Or Nike, if you're American, I guess. Yeah, and the winter training began in 1996. Kenya were only given one slot for Nagano, 98. And Bwak got it. His colleague, who the guy was doing it with him, was a chap called Henry Bittock. He basically just, when he didn't qualify for the Olympics, so as you might imagine, he didn't carry on skiing.
Fair enough.
But Bwak's participation in the Games, captured the imagination of everyone. Worldwide media coverage. He finished 92nd and last in the 10K classic race.
But this is
the reason I want to tell the story, mate, is because at the awards ceremony at the end of the race, you know, the medal ceremony, it was delayed because the winner, Bjorn Dahle, I think he must be Danish, basically refused to go and get his medal until Bois finished. And he waited at the finish line for him and embraced him like when he crossed the line. And
He's Norwegian, by the way.
But Norwegian, there you go.
It would have been my next guess. I would have guessed Danish first. But yeah, that's the Olympic spirit right there. And you do not create that brilliant moment where the champion delays his ceremony to see home his another fellow competitor.
Yeah.
Someone who's put a huge amount of effort to be there, just as he has, and deserves the applause as much as anyone, as much as all 92 of them did.
Yeah.
Incredible.
It is incredible. And Bois went on, actually. He did carry on competing. He went to the 2002 and 2006 games and narrowly missed out on qualification in 2010. But he didn't finish last. So, you know.
There you go.
There you go. And look, that's a nice way to end it. Underdogs. There's going to be plenty of them. There always are. They maybe not might not be on the sort of same sort of extreme end of the spectrum as Eddie the Eagle or Philip Bois, but, you know, dare to dream.
Indeed, it shows the cold winter sports aren't just for cold climates or wealthy nations. People from poorer nations and warmer climates can still have a go, can still compete, and can still get there. And that's what it should be all about.
Well said, mate. I can't add anything to that. So, shall we draw this one to a close and try and entice people back by introducing our next episode?
It shouldn't take much enticing, because this is one of the biggest scandals in the history of sport. And it's tasty. It's been made into a film in the past 10 years. I can't wait. Yeah. It's going to be good.
Figure skating, Tonya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan.
Yeah.
Looking forward to discussing it with you, pal.
Likewise. And I'll see you there.
See you in a bit. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you for joining us for our Winter Olympics series. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please tell a friend about it. We'll be covering everything from speed skating to snowboarding, from ice hockey to figure skating, and much more. There really is something for everyone. Once you've done that, please give us a like, a subscribe, a share or a comment, and tune in for the rest of the series of one of our 40-odd other episodes on the sporting world as well. Our theme tune is Oh Yeah by Harmonia Productions. You can find us on Blue Sky and Instagram at The Sporting Almanac. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy the games as much as we certainly will. From both of us, goodbye for now.